Welcome to Changing Futures, the podcast aimed at helping Birmingham's most vulnerable people live more fulfilled lives. In this series, we'll explore the importance of lived experience when working with people in the areas of homelessness, substance misuse, mental health, and reoffending. Acknowledging the link between trauma and later behaviour, how these issues can affect any one of us, but that some individuals are more at risk than others. We'll hear from those whose lives have been greatly improved by the work of Birmingham Changing Futures Together and learn how those people have been let down in the past by the services and systems set up to help them. The series will explore the multiple and complex, often unmet needs of individuals and focus on the benefits of lived experience in service design and delivery and collaboration. In this episode, we meet Becky and Jason, whose multiple and complex needs resulted in them both becoming homeless. We hear how the systems had let them down and how they finally found the help they needed through services under the Birmingham Changing Futures Together umbrella.
I'm Becky.
Becky, could you tell me a little bit about your journey with and towards homelessness?
I moved to Birmingham because my mental health was very bad and I wasn't able to get the care I needed for it in Belfast. I knew some people here, I knew the healthcare was much, much better in Birmingham. When I moved, I had all the money together for first month's rent, deposit on a house, some money to buy myself the furniture I would need to get started out. But very quickly I found that there was a barrier in the way of a lot of landlords and agencies wouldn't accept people who were on housing benefit or who were unemployed, which I was long-term unemployed because of mental illness. So I found that the money sort of fritters away because not having a home, I couldn't cook myself, I was taking takeaways and sleeping on people's sofas and then giving them money because I was staying at their home and using their electric and gas. And within about 9 months, that money was just gone. So at that point, no home, no money, nowhere to go. I went to the City Council with the help of Shelter, because at first the city, Birmingham City Council, wouldn't accept me as homeless. They said I was intentionally homeless, despite me explaining to them that I had tried everything I could to try and get a home. But when Shelter went with me, they were very helpful. They helped me get a letter from my psychiatrist to back up the fact that I didn't have anywhere safe to stay at that point, and that the situation wasn't really greatly impacting on my mental health. I was suicidal because I thought I couldn't see a way out of my situation, and I couldn't see any way other than I was going to end up sleeping on the streets within a couple of months if I didn't get anything to do. So the council put me up in emergency accommodation in the Norfolk Hotel in Birmingham. It's a very scary experience to go into emergency accommodation, especially I was on two crutches at that point. My physical mobility isn't great. I was put in a room that was up two sets of stairs, and when I went and told them that I can't go up two sets of stairs, it was as if I was ungrateful for the room that I had. They put me in a room that was down a corridor with most of the lights out in the corridor, and there were men, women, all sorts of mixture in the hostel. There were people who you could tell had multiple complex needs like myself, and it was quite intimidating. I was scared to be there. I was scared to leave my room. I was afraid that if something happened to me in the hostel, there was nothing I could do about it. I was there for about 3 weeks then, and in that time I still slept in my car because it felt safer to sleep in my own car, which I could lock.
And while all this is happening, what's happening to your mental health?
I was suicidal by the time I actually found a house. I was under the care of the crisis home treatment team. I was aware that if I went into hospital, it would be even more difficult to come out and get a home. I couldn't be in hospital and look for somewhere to live, but I would have lost my space in the Norfolk Hotel. As bad as it was, at least it was somewhere that I could have an address that was fixed.
And what changed? What was the tipping point to things getting better?
The tipping point was contacting Shelter. They have helped me to communicate with potential landlords and agencies. They helped me to go to the homeless office and get that application sorted out. And I think the biggest thing they did was help me to accept that I was actually homeless, because I never considered myself as homeless in that year, because to me homelessness was sleeping on the streets in a sleeping bag, not having anywhere to go at all. but I've since found out that 62% of the homeless population in the country was in the same position as me, either in emergency accommodation or with sofa surfing, sleeping in cars, things like that.
Tell me a little bit about your work with Every Step of the Way.
Every Step of the Way I came across through the No Wrong Door system in Birmingham when I went to shelter because I was homeless and suffering from severe mental health difficulties. I was passed through this system, which is incredible, of 22 different organisations where they refer you through to anyone that's appropriate to help. So I was referred through to Birmingham Mind with a view to trying to rebuild my life, look at what I can do, because at the point I was with when I was referred to them, I didn't think I would ever be able to work again. I just felt worthless and I was ashamed of my situation. I felt like everything had fallen apart. But the work that I've been able to do with Birmingham Mind and now Every Step of the Way has meant that I feel I have a purpose again. I'm able to use my voice and my experience to go and tell people who actually can make a difference what's happened to me and what's happening to other people and how that affects people and how they can actually change their policies and their actions to help other people in my situation or worse than that.
It's great to hear that things are looking up for Becky. Jason's route into homelessness was different, but all too common a story.
I was living in Bristol, was married with a job and a family, usual conventional life, whatever that may be, and I developed issues of alcohol. And I became what I now know to be a functioning alcoholic, which was incredibly difficult with the job that I had. At that time, I was managing a service in Bristol, a mental health service, with obviously the responsibilities that entails, raising a family. My ex-wife was jointly managing a hospital. So as you can imagine, it was quite a... I say it's a bit like spinning plates, and it's insidious as it took over and all the rest of it, and the clandestine sort of drinking, and it was all rather horrible and what have you. But ultimately led to the breakup of my marriage and the end of my career. I ended up on the streets in the West Midlands and quite vulnerable, and I was hospitalised numerous times. Salvation Army took me in, effectively saved my life, managed to get pockets of recovery. They were wonderful, actually, and then I was lucky enough to get involved with Crisis. Due to the the lifestyle, there has been health issues. I went to the shop one evening, collapsed, and a couple of guys went past, called an ambulance, and I'd suffered a substantial bleed on the brain that was potentially life-threatening. So I spent nearly 3.5 months in hospital. I came out, didn't look after myself at all. And so I lost most of the sight of my left eye due to my diabetes. But incrementally is probably the best term that I can use, managed to get myself back into the human race. And that sounds a bit melodramatic. Got myself involved with the fellowships, AA and what have you, 12-step sort of fellowship. And after 6 months, I went into a recovery-based home and relapsed. Went on the streets again. I just left. I just didn't go back. And it was around Christmas, I collapsed again, and I nearly suffered a diabetic coma. My blood sugar's just gone over 1. So Heartland Hospital got me in and detoxed me.
So while you were in the thick of that alcoholism and you became homeless, how did the two connect and relate to each other, and how was each one holding you back?
I've seen it time and time again. People go on the streets. See, I've been in hostels with people that didn't even have an issue with any substance at all. And within a matter of days in a hostel, I was offered heroin, I was offered crack, which unfortunately I ended up doing. It was never my thing. But I've seen how they can work. They flow. It's almost organic. You know, you've got someone that goes in a vulnerable position, they go into homelessness, they go into a world where, the, you know, these things are almost coping mechanisms and strategies. You know, on one hand, chicken and the egg, people are in those situations because of, but the number one reason for homelessness is relationship breakdown. So these people go in to whether it be a hostel or whatever it is, an addiction can follow. And of course, once you've got the both, you know, almost like being dual diagnosed, if you will, this is where the government, I think, fall down, is because with alcohol and drugs and any illicit substances, one of the things is the mental health side of it, and they don't work in tandem to deal with it. And I believe homelessness is a very similar vein. They sort of tackle one, and you've got the tackle of, but there's a lack of communication. You know, never going to be a perfect world, but I do believe there needs to be some communication between the two. There needs to be access to both of these organisations, whether it's the homeless organisation, and whether it's everything from signposting to where you get your benefits, to seeking accommodation, which is the crux of the problem, to having the support, to giving you, you know, those opportunities to maybe get the career, you know, get a qualification. I know that crisis are adept and are brilliant at doing that, but on the other hand, supporting and dealing with and addressing an alcohol or a drug addiction.
Tell me a little bit about your work as an expert by experience and using your lived experience to help others. How's that helped you?
For structure, it's nice to be involved in something that you can see that can possibly implement system change, that is almost tangible in helping. You know, they really do help, whether it be for homelessness, mental health issues, recovery-based stuff, you know, trouble, you know, with probatory things as well. You know, it's nice to have something to get out of bed for, to be involved in, to network. You've got the practical things of what you get out of it, plus you can see the benefits of being part of something. It's a big thing to have someone show any amount of faith in you when you have showed precious little in yourself. And what have you. So there's a few different reasons, and the work they do is really good. You know, I've been quite lucky to be involved in the things that I've done in a very short space of time. So I get a huge amount out for my mental well-being, my emotional well-being, physical well-being as well. I believe it's holistic. I believe they're all interlinked. Spiritual well-being ticks most of the boxes, really.
What would you say to anybody who was in a position of implementing changes within systems and practices that are currently out there and available? What would you say there needs to be more of?
Prejudice and stigma are huge barriers, and they do exist. They really do. Whether you're being peeled off a pavement and gone into A&E, where you go into a busy ward that's been running on agency nurses that are up against it, that you know, you've got someone that comes in that's been intoxicated, you can understand almost the resentment towards them. I believe that and other countries have adopted this stance, you know, the judgmental, punitive sort of these, and understandably so. You know, if someone breaks their leg, you see it. When you see someone that is in a self-destructive cycle, it's very difficult to empathise with that person when the collateral damage around them mounts. And effectively, you know, that person cannot change without wanting to change themselves. This is a two-way thing. They have to be willing to do it, but they also need systems in place. So I believe that, you know, the funding is a big thing, but it needs people that understand and empathise and have insight, because it's very difficult to empathise and understand someone that will continually do a behaviour that is destroying them. You know, I speak for myself. I was married with a mortgage and a comfortable lifestyle, with a family, a loving family, and a long marriage, a good job, and I couldn't stop. And I could see my world falling apart in front of me, and I couldn't stop. I was powerless. And on the outside, it can be deemed to be selfish, it can be irresponsible, but I ceased to care what I was doing to myself. You know, it mounted up and all the rest of it. So it needs someone that can understand what it is that makes someone want to do a behaviour that is ultimately going to destroy them if they carry on doing it.
And do you think by working with somebody who has that understanding and that lived experience, it in some way has the capacity to fast track you to a point of recovery?
I think it's a hugely beneficial thing, because, you know, the prejudice and the stigma and the lack of trust can go both ways. If you've had someone at, and I've seen it time and time again, has failed by the educational system, that's been failed by services, that has slipped through the net, you know, that are going to be resistant to change. They may want to change more than anything, but if there isn't the systems in place to be able to facilitate that change, they're not going to. And I believe that it's a combination of an empathic approach, a non-punitive approach. It has to be very much person-centred, but also within the constraints of the boundaries as well. There needs to be continuity of approach, but also with that understanding that we're all human.
Huge thanks to Becky and Jason for sharing their stories with us. In the next episode, Ian and Dan share their stories of early trauma and reoffending. Thank you for listening to Changing Futures, the podcast aimed at helping Birmingham's most vulnerable people live more fulfilled lives.